Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Coming up later in the program, we'll play highlights from and invite your reactions to the Democratic presidential debate last night. First, however, we will start, as we usually do on Fridays, with our weekly Ask the Mayor segment, My Questions and Yours, for Mayor Bill de Blasio. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692, or you can tweet a question using the hashtag AskTheMayor. And listeners, I'll just say for the record that we'll stick mostly to city issues as we do in these appearances. Our policy during the mayor's presidential campaign, and the mayor has been very cooperative with this, has been to keep this segment overwhelmingly as a safe space for what matters locally, as the mayor gets asked in so many other places about the national campaign. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to WNYC in that context.
That is a fair ground rule there, Brian. Thank you. Good morning.
And I will say just briefly for today, last night was the first round of debates you didn't qualify for, and you said if you don't qualify for the October debate, you might drop out. I believe the deadline for qualifying with enough donors and poll numbers is October 1st. Can you give us a status report?
Well, more work to do, but I will say that some of the proposals that I've put forward in the last few weeks, obviously the proposal to revitalize Puerto Rico and its economy and protect its environment and resiliency for Puerto Rico, that got some good attention. The proposal on automation got a lot of attention, and I'm saying something very different than the other candidates on how we have to confront the challenge of automation, which will affect tens of millions of American workers. So these kind of ideas, I think, have a life of their own and bring a lot of support, and there's still time on the clock, so I'm going to keep putting them out there.
And on local implications, the Post calculated last month that 70% of the people who have donated to your presidential campaign are hotel workers, and Crane says you gave them a big favor by ordering the City Planning Commission to draft a plan to require full City Council approval for all new hotels. Presumably, Council would only approve those that will allow workers to unionize, and a Crane's column calls this a most public quid pro quo. Is it that? And if not,
no.
Why this policy now?
No, that's ridiculous. We've been working on this policy for years, have been implementing it around the city because hotels have a different impact on communities than other types of usage. In fact, in the Bloomberg administration, they started putting these kind of rules into place. So that's an outrageous allegation. In fact, we make decisions on the merits. And I think this is just plain good policy, and it should be used in all parts of the city. But I also want to note, there's only been a handful of presidential candidates who have a union endorsement so far. And I think it's four unions in the whole country have endorsed, and I'm one of them with the Hotel Trades Council. They've been very, very active because they're a progressive union. They know that I have an agenda that's about helping working people, protecting working people, actually strengthening labor unions' role in our society. They endorse me because I had a track record of getting things done for working people, and they have a really active union that gets involved. Workers get involved because they care about what's happening in this country.
Although
that's a very healthy thing.
Although Cranes concludes that with respect to the hotel workers and most of the bigger donors to your presidential bid, that they are people whose business ventures depend in some way on action by your administration. And they say, you know, reveals something that people should be concerned about.
Well, I just disagree with the entire assumption. We've made a whole host of decisions for working people in New York City. Look, I was ahead of the curve in 2012, 2013, talking about the fact that we were living a tale of two cities. It's true in the whole country as well. And that we actually had to confront income inequality and change the rules of the game in favor of working people. It should not surprise anyone that a lot of working people and a lot of labor unions think that's really important and are supportive for that reason. And other folks who I've worked with over the years, if they think I've done good work and they want to be supported for that reason, again, the people you've worked with who have seen your work firsthand supporting you, that's not a news flash. So the bottom line is, after 5.5 years, I think we've been extraordinarily consistent. Go back, Brian, to the original platform in 2013. I challenge you, I challenge WNYC, go through that platform and look at how much of it has been implemented very loyally, very specifically. I would say a lot more than most people who run for office put out there. It's been all about helping working people, and we make those decisions, and a lot of powerful interests have not liked it. We've had plenty of pushback from the landlord lobby, from the real estate world, all sorts of powerful forces, but we've actually followed through on that agenda, and that's why I think I have gotten support from working people.
But do you dispute the fact at all, and last thing on this, but the fact as framed by Cranes that most of the bigger donors to your presidential bid are people whose business ventures, or I'll add jobs with respect to the hotel workers union, depend in some way on action by your administration?
I don't accept that, because the folks who have donated are folks I have worked with and know. I make the decisions on the merits. It just doesn't stand to reason that if people who are supporting you are people who know your work, have worked with you, that's about them seeing the impact I've had in New York City. This is a city with the most jobs we've ever had, the safest big city in America, the highest graduation rate we've ever had. A lot of folks are New Yorkers who care about New York and have seen the changes here, believe in them, and want to be supportive, because I'm spreading a message about a very different approach, which has now been proven in New York, a progressive approach focused on working people. It's not theory. It's not a position paper. We've actually done it here. And a lot of people understand that and are supportive of it.
Natasha in Glendale. You're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello, Natasha.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mr. Mayor. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to bring to your attention, Mr. Mayor, this issue in this part of Queens where I am, which is sort of on the border of Glendale and Ridgewood, of some really aggressive driving, which kind of goes against your Vision Zero campaign, which I'm so, in love with. I think it's a wonderful campaign and really in support of. But, excuse me, in the last few months even, I've noticed instances in this area where drivers are, there's a culture of aggression here in driving, and it makes makes it really unsafe for pedestrians, for bicyclists, and of course for the drivers. Over the last few months, I've been both pregnant and now have a baby, and have encountered times where drivers either just blow through stop signs or sort of lurch into the intersection while folks are crossing. Like, I was crossing with my stroller the other day, and a driver aggressively lurched towards me after he had stopped to kind of make me hurry up. And then
Natasha,
recently,
let me just jump in for time. Do you move around the city, and do you have reason to think it's worse in your neighborhood of Glendale for any reason?
I don't know the reason, honestly, but yes, I work in Manhattan and have lived in Brooklyn. You know, we just moved from Brooklyn to Queens in the spring, and so absolutely, I do notice a big difference. Mm-hmm. There's also this, there are two-way streets here that are the same width as a one-way street in other neighborhoods, with parking on both sides, which makes it really challenging to maneuver both as a driver and as a bicyclist.
All right, let's get a response. Mr. Mayor.
Well, Natasha, first of all, thank you for what you said about Vision Zero. It is something that I think has really changed life in the city, and it's only really begun. I mean, we've got a lot more ahead, and it's the whole goal is to change the culture and behavior, to get people to think very, very differently about how they drive and what impact it could have on the people around them, and obviously changing everything we do. The speed limit, the speed cameras, the police enforcement, all the things that make Vision Zero stronger, we're going to just deepen them all the time. So thank you for supporting that vision. On your point, look, one, I'd like you to give your information to WNYC, and my team will follow up with you today. If there's particular locations you think have become areas where folks really drive too fast, consistently, too aggressively, that may mean we have to do changes in those areas in terms of the street design or what kind of signals are there, what kind of enforcement. So I welcome when everyday New Yorkers say, hey, we've got a problem in a particular location. In fact, that helps us to figure out all the places that we need to focus on. So I would appreciate if you do that. And on the bigger point, I think what we have to figure out in each and every case is, what will fix the problem. Sometimes, again, it is only a physical change will really get to the heart of it. Sometimes it's more enforcement. Sometimes it's a speed camera. It really depends. We're going to be able to do a lot more speed cameras now around schools. And to your point, Natasha, it's kind of amazing. When I started out with Vision Zero, I can't tell you how many people said to me, this is going to cause outrage. You know, so many people in the city will not accept it. It's change. You know, drivers will be unhappy. And it's something New Yorkers should be proud of, that we're 6 years in now, and in fact, it is wildly popular and highly supported, and a lot of drivers have said to me it made them think differently. It made them change their behavior. So we've got to do that everywhere, and we certainly have to focus on the places where we see particular dangers. And I feel what you said as a parent, too, that, you know, when you're a parent, you're really worried about the safety of your kids. And if we have places we have to do more, we're devoted to doing more. So please share that information.
All right. Natasha, hang on. We'll get your contact information. This has not been the best year in terms of the direction of things for Vision Zero. And sometimes individual crashes, you know, land on the public imagination much more than the stats. There was the death recently of the 10-year-old on a sidewalk who was hit by a car. And I see City Councilman Brad Lander has a bill that he calls the Reckless Driver Accountability Act, which includes booting or impounding cars that accumulate five or more red light and speed camera violations within a year, expanding the driver accountability program currently offered in Red Hook and on Staten Island as an alternative for drivers who were ticketed for moving violations, also requiring the city to produce an annual study on dangerous driving. So what do you think of the provisions of Brad Lander's bill?
I haven't seen his bill, but I can tell you that I've worked closely with Brad. I come from the same community in Brooklyn, and we had a horrible tragedy. Actually, sounds a little bit similar to the tragedy in Brooklyn a few days ago, that a driver with a medical condition. And you remember that horrible tragedy in Park Slope and the loss of children. When you see something like that, that could have been stopped by better laws. In that case, it required state laws to say that if someone has a medical condition that could at any point lead them to be a dangerous driver, their doctors, being knowledgeable about that, should have to report that to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Look, if someone might endanger others, I don't want to be disrespectful of their need for mobility, but if they can't control their own actions, they shouldn't be driving a car. We need a state law that helps us address that. In terms of the items in Brad Lander's bill, they sound directionally correct. And again, we need to see the exact language, but they certainly sound directionally correct. We need to have more accountability. And I'm someone who spent a lot of my life in New York City without a car. And then once I had two kids, I got a car and dealt with all the challenges of driving, but also came to recognize how much driving in this city is an act that requires a whole lot of attention and focus and respect for pedestrians and bicyclists. And we just have to profoundly change the culture. We cannot leave the kind of classic American assumption that, you know, the car is the dominant part of our society. That's not acceptable. And there has to be accountability. And there's a long way to go, particularly on our state laws, to get there. But the good news, Brian, is there's been real progress over the years. There's been a growing understanding that we have to change things. And we are going to keep doing that. So Vision Zero is going to keep growing. But I think the legal structure, the more laws that create real accountability, the more it sends a message to people that you really have to take seriously what it means to be a driver.
Apparently not everybody loves Vision Zero. Here's Mehdi in Brooklyn. Mehdi, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning.
Excuse me for my English. I'm not very good at it.
You're doing fine, Mehdi.
Thank you. Try to explain, Vision Zero is good. Much of it is good, but recently I'm seeing all the streets being keep getting painted and painted, direction changed, all the right turns and left turns being blocked off, parking spaces taken away, and that's causing more congestion in the city. I mean, this Vision Zero seemed like tilted toward in favor of bicyclists and the pedestrians. But what about me as a driver? I mean, can we coexist and have more toward making some changes so that this can be Vision 2020, and then cars, bicycles, and pedestrians all can coexist together. And thank you.
Thank you, Mehdi. It's a great question, but I would first say the way you frame the question, I think, points out something important. The pedestrians are the most vulnerable in the whole equation. And that's the vast majority of the people on our streets and sidewalks, and they need to be protected first. So by any normal rule of the majority, that's where we have still a lot more work to do. I would disagree with your assumption about a lot of the street changes. A lot of the street changes have been made, in fact, to improve the flow of traffic. And what we did recently with the Taxi and Limousine Commission to put a cap on for-hire vehicles, the Ubers, the Lyfts, et cetera, that were clogging up our streets, to require them only to cruise around empty for a limited period of time. I mean, these are things that make an impact for sure, but then the positive side of the equation is to increase and improve the mass transit options. So when you look at this city today compared to 6 years ago, there's actually some good news here. Finally, everyone got together, city and state, came up with a plan to fix the MTA, the subways, the buses, through congestion pricing. That's a long, complex struggle, but we got there. We have more bike lanes than we've ever had. We have more select bus service, buses that move much more smoothly than we've ever had, and a lot more coming. We have the ferry system, which is becoming more and more popular. We're actually doing a lot in this city to give people better options to get out of their cars. So if you're a professional driver, you know, what I actually think you'll find over time is the more people use mass transit, the fewer Ubers and Lyfts on the street, the more the streets will start to clear up, and it will be a better environment for drivers. But when it comes to the big, big picture, it's always safety first. Safety first begins with pedestrians. And we've got to protect pedestrians. Of course we've got to protect bicyclists, but you know what? Pedestrians actually come first, and sometimes with both cars and trucks and bicyclists, pedestrians can be endangered. So as we continue to develop Vision Zero, it's always going to be about protecting pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists, but then also finding new ways to create mass transit that opens up our streets even further.
City Council Speaker Cory Johnson, as I'm sure you know, actually uses the words he wants to break car culture in New York City. Do you endorse that language? Would you use that language yourself or characterize that as your goal?
But I think the point is it doesn't have to be constructed as a negative. I think what people need to understand is we owe it to the people of the city to give them positive alternatives. And the more and better our mass transit, the more people will choose it. And I want to say, as someone who's been through the whole cycle of, didn't have a car, did have a car, now I'm someone after this work where I'm quite adamant I'm not going to own a car going forward. We have more and better mass transit options today than we've probably had in our history. We've got still a long way to go. And if we keep improving them, it's like if you build it, they will come. If we all, city and state together, keep improving mass transit options, folks won't need their car in more and more instances. And I think it's important for motorists to always ask the question, do they have another option? Use it if they do. So, I think we're moving in the right direction. I agree with Cory strongly on a government that used to favor cars over all other interests, which certainly was our federal government and too often state and local government as well. Those days are over. Now it needs to be about mass transit and safety first.
Nick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello, Nick.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. Mr. Mayor, in the face of growing criticism about your affordable housing plan and pressure from homeless activists and advocates, you've denied subsidizing luxury housing in New York City. But one project listed on the city's housing website at 15 Bridge Park Drive in Brooklyn, 29 studios or one-bedroom apartments rent for $3,000 a month for people earning between $101,000 and $140,000 a year. So you're adding to an already bifurcated housing market where there is a glut of high-rent apartments, but more than 61,000 people live in homeless shelters across the city. Why do you keep telling the public that you're not building luxury housing when you're subsidizing buildings like this one? And how can you justify city-subsidized luxury housing production at a time when we have record homelessness and suffering in our city?
Well, Nick, those facts just that's just not the reality that you are presenting respectfully. The fact is the Affordable Housing Plan has been out in public since May of 2014, delineated the whole range of incomes. We do reach some folks who have incomes that are clearly more middle class incomes. That is a true statement. And when you think about how much a teacher makes in New York City today, a police officer, all sorts of people in public service, all sorts of people who work careers in the private sector, there's lots of middle class people. When you combine their income, they get into that level, and they're still struggling to stay in this city. So, no, we've said from the beginning that is a piece of our plan, but if you look at the numbers, it's a small piece of the plan. It's actually getting smaller. The vast majority of the affordable housing plan is for folks who clearly are in, you know, moderate income, working class folks, and lower income folks. It just the numbers make it abundantly clear. And so you also have to ask the question about folks who, God forbid, became homeless. 100,000 people who went into our shelter system in the last 6 years, we were able to get to affordable housing. So there's a kind of a symbolism, if you will, being put out there that rarely references the facts. If 100,000 people who became homeless, we helped to affordable housing, which there's no parallel anywhere else in the country of that kind of positive strategy to get people to affordability. We have the biggest affordable housing creation program in New York City history, overwhelmingly for working class and lower income folks. Right. And getting more so. And the other point is, most of our affordable housing program is going into communities of working class folks and lower income folks and keeping them in their own apartments, paying 30% of their income in rent for decades to come. It's not even new construction. It's preserving affordable housing we have and making sure people can stay there. So I think all of that is consistent with protecting the interests of everyday New Yorkers.
Just specific on this particular detail and this particular class of housing, because I got a release from the group that I gather Nick is associated with since he brought up 15 Bridge Park Drive. It says 29 studios or one-bedroom apartments there rent for $3,000 a month for people earning between $101,000 and $141,000 a year, and they object to that being subsidized.
So, okay, look at the salary of some of our public servants, you know, who do work that we all depend on, and everyday folks up at the front line, teachers, police officers, et cetera, and then think about a two-income family. You're talking about a lot of folks who we would say are middle-class people who also need to have a place in this city. And if you talk to middle-class New Yorkers who have tried to find something they could buy in New York City for a home and cannot in many places, and you say, don't they also need to be a part of the city? We want an income mix. We want an economically diverse city. Now, again, the facts, Brian, it's a very small piece of the affordable housing plan. And what we often do when we create new affordable housing is we're balancing the economics. We're actually making the developers build the affordable housing for the people in New York City. And there's an income mix typically in lots of buildings. And there may be some units that are for more middle-class people, and there's often a lot of units for folks who make a lot less. But the point is, this is just to me a I don't want to say it's disingenuous. I'm sure the people raising the concern are doing it in a heartfelt manner. But it's a ignoring of the facts. We can't just do affordable housing. I'll say this very clearly. Affordable housing initiatives cannot just be for the lowest income folks. We have a real obligation to the lowest income folks, and we also have everything we're doing to try and revive the 400,000, the work of NYCHA to help 400,000 New Yorkers who live there. Sure. And we have over 2 million people in rent-regulated apartments, and those rules and laws just got a lot stronger, which is great. But there has to be a place for workforce housing and middle-class housing as well. So, and that's been from the beginning. It's not a news flash. We said that in May 2014, and we've continued to do it.
Sambe in the Bronx. You're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello, Sambe.
Hello. Good morning, Mr. Bryant. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, sorry about that comment. Hopefully you understand my saying. I live in the Bronx, Mr. Mayor, and also I would say, unfortunately, I own a car. And there's a problem that came to me three times, Mr. Mayor. I live around the Bronx, who I don't know if you're familiar with the area. And basically, three times my car got busted. And then the second time that it happened, I called the police to file a report. And when they came, Mr. Mayor, I mean, They asked me if anything was missing in the car. I told them no. And from that moment, they told me that there was nothing they could do to help me. And the third time happened this Monday. The window got busted again. And I go to school by Lehman College. Around there, the same scenario is happening. Cars are getting busted. Windows are getting busted. And then basically, I'm coming to you, Mr. Mayor, if you have anything to do to help us. Because basically, I don't know where to park. Because I try to park around my house, but the DMV too, same scenario.
Sambe, can I ask, are you have you been in that area for a while, and do you think the vandalism or other crime situation is getting worse recently?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. I will tell you, the first time that it happened goes to be 2 years ago. The second time, let's put a year, and the third time, this one, as I'm saying, since I go to Lehman College, I see a lot of cars. Because the pattern is all about seeing the bus in the little window to get into the car, searching for something in there. I mean,
yeah,
I'll be trying.
So Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Brian, first to you. There's a real issue when people don't feel safe. That always means we have more to do. And or when their experience, as Sambe has experienced, is that something's happened in their life that makes them feel unsafe. You know, that is something we must address. But I want to be careful the way you just phrased the question. We want to hear what people feel. We want to hear what they see. But we also have to pay attention to the bigger facts. The changes in the city, the reduction in crime, the reduction in robberies, the reduction in vehicle thefts, it's a strong, clear trend. It's been deepening the last 6 years. I sometimes find that people want to search for signs of something that isn't there, because I trust the NYPD's accounting of what is happening in New York City, and it clearly shows these kind of crimes have consistently gone down, and kudos to the men and women of the NYPD. And I think they're going to go down further. But that said, for Sambe, please give your information to WNYC, because what you described troubles me. Our officers have an obligation to help each resident to know that there will be follow-up on their concern or their problem. If your car window is broken, that's a big deal. And we need to take that seriously, and we need to look for, you know, any evidence of who did it so that we can stop it from happening again. So obviously I wasn't there when you had the conversation with the officers, but I want all New Yorkers to know the expectation is that every crime is taken seriously and is followed through on.
What?
And obviously the most serious crimes get the most attention, but every crime matters. There was a time, Brian, that you, I think, will remember, where there were a host of crimes in the city. If you called it in, the police had so many challenges they were dealing with, and they often couldn't get to lower-level crime. But that's different today. Now they can, because we've driven down crime so much. So I don't want anyone to ever feel they were blown off. I want their concern to be taken seriously.
Well, one follow-up then from one thing we talked about last week. Since the firing of Officer Daniel Pantaleo, Police Commissioner O'Neill had reported that misdemeanor arrests were down 18% from the year before in the same weeks. Felony arrests were down 11%, and moving violations for motorists were down by a third. It's just a week later. Do you have any new stats to see if anything like that is continuing that indicates a job action by disgruntled police officers?
No, I don't have any indication of that. I mean, I'll continue to talk to the commissioner about it, but I think what the commissioner said previously is the reality. Our officers, if you look at the month of August when all this happened, crime went down this August compared to last August. Gun arrests went up. And the NYPD had some really remarkable successes, particularly in Brooklyn, the Juve celebration, the West Indian Day parade. You know, a lot of things were done very, very well, and with tremendous professionalism. And that's what I'm seeing around the city overwhelmingly. So there's some small pockets we have to deal with. Those precinct commanders will deal with that, but I have no indication of a bigger challenge.
And one other follow-up from last week's show before we run out of time. Some listeners may remember that a few months ago I asked you on this program whether you would consider a lawsuit against the companies that made lead paint, because California was successful in that kind of suit and was awarded just over $400 million. And at the time, with the ongoing lead paint challenges that the city is dealing with and the expense. You said the city's legal team was looking into a similar suit, and you told us last week that you would report back today on where that stands. Do you have it?
I have my homework ready, Brian. And it's a great question. So our law department looked at this very carefully. I think the base, so first of all, a fact that wasn't evident in our previous discussion is that there was an effort previously in the 80s and 90s by the city of New York and by NYCHA to bring that type of lawsuit against the lead paint companies. And it went on for years, and it was a costly enterprise that did not reach a conclusion. And part of the reason why is California has very different laws than we have that were more conducive to the action that the state of California brought. So I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying based on the research we've done so far, we don't think we have a pathway to achieve that. I would love to. As you know, we are suing the pharmaceutical companies over opioids. We're suing the oil companies over what they did to facilitate global warming and hide the facts from us. There's plenty of instances where the city of New York is very aggressive with litigation. But this one was tried, and it just doesn't look like we have the same opportunity to do what California did.
Mr. Mayor, thanks as always. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.